was now the fourth consecutive day. After I'd left the day before, the staff discussed the state of my sobriety and took me out of three of the sketches I was in. They decided to limit my liability to one sketch with Nicole Sullivan, in which I played an annoyed guy. Nicole was doing her popular recurring character, Vancomb Lady. My familiarity with those sketches plus Nicole's talent meant I could go on automatic pilot. Plus, at that point, portraying an annoyed, angry guy came rather easily to me. I was able to wing it, but it was becoming obvious to everyone that something was wrong. To my mind, though, it was another successful day at the office. So after I was done at about noon, it was Miller time. I went down to Sunset, scored more coke at a bar I can't remember, then in yet another stroke of genius, decided to put $3,000 on a Houston Rockets-LA Lakers game that was being played in Houston. I called my guy in Staten Island, and he had the Lakers giving the Rockets 5 points. That was the Lakers' first year with Shaq, and I fucking hated them, so I bet the Rockets. I'm an idiot, of course. The Lakers beat them easily. There was another $3,300, with the VIG, gone, which brought my grand total in gambling losses for the week to about $21,800, my entire savings. First thing I did the next morning was to call my mother to ask her to send me more money. "Ma, I need you to Western Union me $5,000 from the savings account," I said. "Artie, why? What happened?" she asked. "Are you in trouble?" "No, Ma, listen, I'll be honest with you. We went to Vegas this weekend, and I gambled a little too much, and I forgot that I owed Orlando for the rent and a bunch of other bills I haven't paid." "Are you telling me the truth, Artie? That money is savings that you were never to touch." "I know, Ma, I know," I said. "I'm just dipping into it this once. I'll replace the money after my next paycheck, I promise." "Okay, just this once." I used the money to pay off my coke dealer and pocketed the rest in anticipation of spending the weekend the same way I'd spent the whole week. I went off to rehearsal, again wearing clothes that reeked of coke and booze. That day we had Harry Connick Jr. on as a musical guest. No offense to him, but at that point, I could not have given less of a shit about meeting him. Throughout rehearsal, whenever he was around, my castmates would say things like, "Straighten up, Artie," under their breath, because I wasn't being very cordial. If it had been Mel Brooks, I would have gotten my act together. But for Harry Connick Jr.? After we wrapped rehearsal, I sought out a little sanctuary back at the Rainbow where I stayed bullshitting and drinking until I ran out of coke at about 9 p.m. I had a feeling that the wolves would soon be at my door because everybody at work now knew what I was up to. I figured I'd cool them down by not getting any more drugs for a night or two and sleeping this bender off. To help me chill out, I got good and loaded on Johnny Walker and decided that I'd sleep over at my friend Carol Saccone's apartment, which was right up the street from the Rainbow. Carol was one of the first people I became friends with when I moved to L.A. She's really a sweet, kind, and generous girl. She was totally drug-free, so I knew if I went over there to get some rest, I'd get it. It seemed like the smart thing to do. I had a 10 a.m. call time to shoot my sketch with Nicole the next morning, and West Hollywood was much closer to the studio than my apartment. I was actually proud of myself for thinking it through, because by staying at Carol's, I'd be able to get more sleep. Little did I know that everyone I knew in L.A. had been calling each other all day long. My friends on the cast and production team at Mad TV saw signs of trouble. I wonder how. But they didn't want to alarm my family back east. They knew I'd had trouble the year before, but they also knew that I'd work hard to get it together, so they thought that some kind of confrontation might do the trick. Their plan was to, like, kidnap me and take me to a hospital for a few days where I could dry out comfortably under constant surveillance. Carol had called Orlando when she'd heard from me, and they'd made arrangements for him to meet us there and take me to get some help. When I walked into Carol's place, she took one look at my homeless guy getup and almost burst into tears. "Artie, I'm sorry, but I'm so scared about what you're doing to yourself," she said. "Orlando is too. We all are." "Listen, Carol, I'm fine," I said. "You got nothing to worry about. I just had a bad week. And the Understatement of the Year award for 1996 goes to Artie Lang Jr." "Artie, I will not let you do coke in my apartment," she said, teary-eyed. "I am really scared for you." "Carol, I'm not going to do any coke. I don't even have any coke." "Artie, I mean it. You can't do any coke here. You're killing yourself." "I'm serious. I don't have any coke. I just finished it like an hour ago. That's it for today. I promise. Tomorrow, of course, is another story, but I promise I won't do any coke here. Artie, please, let's go to a hospital." "Why, are you sick? Because I don't need to go to a hospital." "Yes, you do, Artie," she said, pleading with me. "Let's just get you to a rehab center right now. Everything will be okay. Orlando is on his way, but let's just go now." "Wait, what?" I ran out of there like I was being chased by the cops, which I guess I was, since Carol ran down the stairs behind me, begging me not to leave. She lived at the end of a dead-end street, and as I ran to my car, all I could think about was that any second Orlando and God knows who else would be pulling up to block my escape. I was driving a shitty Ford Taurus at the time, and I wished that someone had caught this on film because it was the greatest thing I'll ever do behind the wheel. I jumped into my car, turned it over, floored it in reverse back down her street at like 85, then slammed on the brakes, spun a 360, and floated out of there. It was some Dukes of Hazzard shit that I would have never been able to do sober, nor have I ever tried to do in any condition since. It was fucking cool. All the more so because I didn't kill anyone. I went right back to the Rainbow, where everybody was starting to know my name, and sat at the bar a few seats down from Andy Dick, who was there with a handler. Andy was jumping up and down off the wall out of his fucking mind on something. He had done some stuff on Mad TV, and we had some LA comedy scene friends in common. I'd only met him briefly, but I knew through our common acquaintances that he had substance problems similar to mine. And he was sitting there yelling out crazy shit as Handler tried to get him to leave. This platinum blonde stripper-looking chick walked over to him and started talking to him. "Hey, Andy, I've seen you on TV. You're really funny," she said. "Yeah, thanks." "Hey, give me some cocaine. I know you have some." That stopped Andy in his tracks. "Get away from me," he shouted real loud. "Fuck you, get away from me, right now." The chick left, but Andy only got more insane until his handler, who was this big Italian guy, decided that it was really time to go. For some reason, the guy came over to me and asked me to help him get Andy to the car. "What?" I said with the utmost disgust. "No. Why would I do that? I don't care about him, and I don't care about you. I don't want to help you get him in the car. Fuck that. I don't care if he gets hit by a fucking car tonight. You're on your own. I got problems of my own here, pal." "Oh, really?" the guy said, looking particularly intimidating and annoyed. "You really not going to help me out of here?" "No, I'm not." He clearly could have beaten me up, but I just did not give a fuck. Someone killing me or beating me up would have been doing me a favor at that point. After the guy managed to get Andy to leave, the same blonde chick slid over to me. "Hey," she said, "can you get me some coke?" I took a long sip of whiskey. "I got money for it, but I don't know where to get any." "I can take care of that," she said. "There's a guy outside who can get us coke if you pay for it. Can I hang with you?" I took a good look at her. She must have been about 38 or 39, and she had really bad acne scars on her face. She had a nice body, fake tits though, and even faker platinum hair, all topped off with a $4 pink miniskirt. "Yeah, whatever, you can hang with me." Outside the bar in the parking lot, she called over a guy who had been hanging out around the corner in the alley. I don't know if he was a bouncer, but he looked like one. Just a big fucking 6'4" biker guy in a leather vest and long black hair. He looked like major trouble. "There he is," she said. "He's got the coke. Give him the money and he'll go get it." "Oh, really?" I said. "Is that how it works? How will I know that he's not just going to take my money and rip me off?" "No, I promise you he won't. You stay here with me. I'll go nowhere while he goes to get it." I literally had very little to lose at this point, so I gave the guy some money and then he left. In 10 minutes he returned with nothing. "Listen, man, I have to go somewhere else to get it in a car." "Dude, what the fuck?" I shouted. "I was not born yesterday, Tonto. You think you're going to just take my fucking money like that? Think again, motherfucker." From the look on his face, the guy obviously felt he'd been insulted. "Dude, this is not New York," he said. "Do not be rude or loud with me, asshole." I'm going out on a limb here, but I assume he figured I was a New Yorker because of my accent. Clearly, he'd never been to New York. If he had, he would have known that people from New York and New Jersey shout at each other when we interact, and it's never considered rude. I found it hilarious, however, that a coke dealer was correcting my etiquette. But I didn't laugh. Instead, I said, "Listen, asshole, fuck you. I don't need a geography lesson from you." That did it. He pulled a knife from his jeans and started marching towards me. Everything was happening in slow motion. I was watching that knife coming towards me, knowing it would be the end of me. I did nothing. I remember thinking, this guy might just kill me. And then what? How much worse could dead be than what I was doing to myself? When he was about a foot away from me, the fucking coke whore stepped right in front of the knife. "Listen, he's okay, baby," she said. "Please don't do anything. He's a good guy and a friend of mine. I can vouch for him. He's just fucked up right now. He's really sorry." I didn't say anything. I just kept staring at the knife in his hand. "You're sorry, right?" she said. "Yes, I'm sorry. Sorry, man." That was enough for the guy. That chick saved my life. The guy went off to get our coke, and we went back into the bar to drink more. I fully expected the guy to never come back, but he did, and even though he overcharged me for the coke, what was I going to do? It wasn't exactly a situation in which you can haggle. This chick lit up like a Christmas tree once we had the coke, so we got in a car and drove to a parking lot and started doing it. I learned rather quickly that she was willing to do a lot of different things for more coke, and I'm not saying it to brag because, really, any guy with a bag of blow could have gotten this chick. It didn't take long for me to get her to give me a blowjob. Considering the week I was having, I expected it to be awful or cause me injury somehow, but the truth is, the girl gave an incredible blowjob. "Listen, honey," I said to her, "that is wonderful, really great, but I should warn you there's no way I'm ever going to come. I've got way too much coke in me. Leave that to me." The whore was right. She got me hard somehow and just kept at it until after a while she made me come in that mind-blowing way that anybody who has ever had sex on cocaine knows about. Sex on coke goes one of two ways with no compromises. You do it for hours and never come at all, or you do it for hours and if you do come, You have the most incredible experience of your life. This blowjob took a while, but I have to say it was the best blowjob I've ever gotten in my entire life. Between the drug binging and the gambling losses, I'd had so much badness around me for the last week that I started to feel my life literally slipping away from me. That blowjob was the only bit of relief, the only good feeling, and the only gift I'd been given in a week that felt like a year. Afterward, we drove out to the ocean and parked in a lot on the Pacific Coast Highway. We sat there with some Coke and a bottle of Jack and talked about life with a nice breeze blowing through the car. At one point, I got quiet because it finally started to dawn on me that I was lucky to be alive considering how self-destructive I'd been. I made one of those drugged-up promises to myself that I'd get it together the very next day. Before the sun started coming up, I drove the chick back to the Rainbow. There I was, faced with the end of the night. For better or worse, it's a lot easier to face in New York, where the bars are open until 4 a.m., and you can stay up all night until it's time to get breakfast, and then sleep all day. In L.A., you have to go home eventually, usually much earlier than you'd like. I knew I had to be at work at 10 a.m. I also knew that Carol would have talked to Orlando, so I couldn't go home. I still had more coke in my pocket, so I did some and thought about where I could spend the night. My skit the next morning was with Nicole Sullivan, a total sweetheart and one of my best friends in the business. She had a place in the Laurel Canyon area of the Hollywood Hills that I'd been to a few times, and I figured she was so nice and passive, she'd let me stay over and go to work with her in the morning. I also figured that she wasn't going to try to force me into rehab on the spot. She'd be too afraid to confront me about drugs right then and there. By the time I found her place and started knocking on her door, very loudly, it was about 3:30 in the morning. She lived on the second floor of a three-family house with this cute ABC executive above her and Krista Miller, who was then on The Drew Carey Show and later on Scrubs, on the ground floor. Krista, who was really good-looking, heard me knocking right away. "What the hell are you doing, Artie?" she said. "Get the fuck out of here. I have to work tomorrow." "Oh, yeah?" I said. "Got to get in there early to learn those complicated lines of Drew Carey, eh, Krista? Good luck with that." "You're being an asshole, Artie." "I'm serious. Good luck. I know it must be tough. If the pressure ever gets to you, I'll be happy to take over." I kept busting her chops, refusing to leave until she was screaming at me loud enough to wake up Nicole. "Krista, it's okay," Nicole said, coming down the stairs. "I'll handle this." "Hey, Nicole, didn't you get my phone call?" I said. "What?" she said. "Let me stay here. We've got the same call time tomorrow. It'll be easier if we drive together." She did not look like she wanted any part of me, and I couldn't blame her, but she has a big heart. "All right, Artie, but you're going to sleep now. It's late." "Oh, yeah, definitely. I need my beauty rest." Nicole set me up on her living room couch with a pillow and blanket and went back to sleep. I did not. I started looking through her CD collection, playing Music Critic. The ones I like, I put in her stereo and played. The ones I didn't like, I did coke off of, scratching them all in the process. Nicole had a beautiful view of L.A., so I threw the living room window open and sat there singing along to every song I played. Her neighbors, one of whom I believe was Jennifer Aniston, referred to this evening as the Bobby McGee night, because the track I put the most heart into was Me and Bobby McGee by Janis Joplin. I was so moved by it that I screamed along at the top of my lungs and woke up the entire block. I didn't care about the awful position I put Nicole in either. By morning, I'd done almost all of my coke and drunk all of my Jack, so I went to her liquor cabinet and took out a bottle and broke it open just as she was making herself some coffee. "So you ready to go, Artie?" "Yep, sure am. Let's do this." "Why don't I drive?" Nicole said. "You can just chill out and ride with me." "Nah. I think you should. You're drinking." "Nicole, I'll be fine. I need my car. I'm fine to drive. Follow me. You'll see." "Okay." Being a petite girl, Nicole really couldn't tell me anything I didn't want to hear. I got in my car and took off with Nicole behind me. At the first light at Lookout Mountain, she got in front of me so she could see how I was driving and kind of be a buffer for me. I followed her all the way down Laurel Canyon, this long winding road, to the corner of Crescent Heights and Sunset in Hollywood. At the stoplight, Nicole turned around to see how I was doing. I'd passed out cold behind the wheel. I was sitting at the red light with my head back against the seat, my mouth open, sucking air, with a bottle of Jack in my hand and a bag of coke up on the dashboard. She ran over to my car. "Artie," she yelled, "wake up. You should not be driving. Please, Artie, just come in my car. Let me drive." "I'm fine," I said. "Fuck you," and I sped off. Nicole got back in her car and called ahead to the studio to let them know what was going on. She said that I was with her, had been at her house all night, was as coked up as a human being could possibly be, and was already drunk at 10 in the morning. "You've got to get somebody there," she told producers. "You've got to have some sort of intervention. He needs to be taken away because he's dangerous. He's driving, for Christ's sakes." Nicole has apologized to me since for doing that, but thank God she did, because she obviously saved my life. If she had not made that decision, I have no idea how or when this run would have ended. Dying was definitely a possibility. Jail and rehab were a much better choice, though at the time I didn't feel that way. Nicole and I arrived at the studio at the same time. I walked in wearing the same clothes I'd had on for 5 days. I saw the usual people who'd been there since 8 a.m., preparing the soundstage, and others who were rehearsing. I had to collect my script in the writer's room, which was at the top of a long flight of stairs, and as I approached, I saw our two executive producers, Fax Barr and Adam Small, and three agents from William Morris, as well as my manager at the time, Ken Trusch. All of them were on their cell phones, and when they saw me, they immediately got shifty. I took one look at all of them at the top of the steps, turned around, and bolted. The steps gave me a good head start, but they were right on my heels. I ran out of the Renmore Studios on Cahuenga, which is just south of Melrose, and where at the time they shot The Practice, and took off down the street. This is another scene from my life that I wish someone had captured on film. Me fleeing from three agents, two executive producers, one manager, and Orlando Jones on a foot race through Hollywood. It must have looked like the last sequence in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I ducked down residential streets, I hid in backyards. I jumped fences, I avoided dogs, and I ran by people lounging at their swimming pools, all with this procession of fuckers behind me. It was L.A., so people didn't freak out the way they would elsewhere. They just must have thought we were filming a movie. The chase ended and my own personal Waterloo began when I turned the corner of Melrose and Vine and ran into the Pavilion supermarket right by Winchell's Donut House. I'd made the mistake of thinking I'd lost him and was trying to catch my breath in the parking lot when they caught up to me. There was no way out but into the market. My manager confronted me in the produce section. "Artie, you gotta stop this, man," he said. "It's gonna be okay, but you can't keep running." "Fuck you, Ken." I punched Ken as hard as I could right in the face, and he went down, falling into a display of grapefruit. "Ken, if you're listening to this, I'm really sorry, man. I know you were just trying to help." As other guys closed in on me, I started pelting them with oranges and pears. At that point, I started throwing fruit at everybody in the store. Old ladies, soccer moms, no one escaped my rage. Everyone in the produce section started to freak out, and there was a kind of mad rush to the door. The supermarket manager called the cops. In the hysteria, and thanks to my expert aim with an orange, I managed to evade my tormentors and ran out of there, right into the welcoming arms of two LAPD officers. They were not at all happy about my food fight. They grabbed me, turned me around, and threw me on the hood of the car. "Calm the fuck down, now!" "Fuck you," I screamed at them. "Shouldn't you cops be beating the shit out of some African-American for speeding?" They turned me around, and I took a full swing at the cop. Thank God in heaven that it was the lamest, most floppy-handed, drunken, coked-out whiff of a punch and missed by a mile. That didn't stop him from slamming me back under the hood with extra gusto. A minute later, I was cuffed, stuffed into the back of the squad car, and totally busted. They searched me, found the coke, and now had a nice list of charges on me. Resisting arrest, public drunkenness, possession of cocaine, and aggravated assault if anyone in the store decided to press charges. Talk about leaving a network show the wrong way. How about doing it in the back of an LAPD drunk wagon after throwing fruit at everyone in the grocery store? I sure made an exit, too. As the producers and a crowd looked on, they dragged me away, while I continued to scream at Orlando Jones until they closed the doors of the paddy wagon on me. For whatever insane reason, I blamed him for the whole thing. "You fucking sold me out, you fucking bastard," I shouted. "I thought you were my friend, you two-faced piece of shit. Fuck you!" For the record, Orlando had done nothing but be a great friend. Since I was so obviously high on drugs, the cops were required to take me to the infirmary at LA County Jail to figure out what kind of shape I was in before they booked me. I eventually realized that I was in deep shit, so I did my best to make friends with these guys, telling them stories, apologizing, and making jokes. Lucky for me, it worked, because when you're in the care of law enforcement, as they like to say, you really don't want to make it any harder on yourself. The cops handcuffed me to a bed in the ER, and a doctor took my blood pressure and a blood sample, then left the room. When he returned, he looked like he'd just seen a murder. I have never seen that much cocaine in a living human being in my entire career in the ER, and I've been doing this for a decade, he told my executive producers. This guy has enough coke in his body to kill a horse. He gave me a sedative, and I passed out while the team that had followed me there came up with a game plan. I woke up hours later to one of the cops who had returned to the hospital. "Listen, buddy, you're going up to L.A. County Jail for a few days," he said, genuinely concerned. "But you don't have to stay here if you can post $10,000 in bail. We can get you out of here tonight." The cop was really doing me a favor, and I'd like to thank him here once again. "Can I make a phone call?" I asked. "I can get the money." It was a no-brainer. I was going to call David in Orlando and ask them to each put up 5 G's. I knew they'd do the right thing, and they did. They said no. "Artie, I'm not going to do it," David said. "I don't care if you never talk to me again. I'm not helping you get out." "Dude, what the fuck? I thought we were friends. How can you leave me in jail like this when you've got the money?" "Everybody would rather have you in jail than dead," he said. "If you're in jail, at least we know where you are and what you're not doing. You're out of control, man. Fuck you, man. Fuck Orlando. Fuck all of you. I never want to hear from you again. And so later that night, when the doctors informed the cops that my vital signs had stabilized to something that resembled a normal human being, I was taken from the prison hospital to the local precinct jail and booked. A few hours after that, I was put on a bus to the LA County Jail with 8 of the fucking shadiest characters you have ever seen. All of them were Crip, Bloods, and Latino gangbangers. Who the fuck knows what they were in for? I got processed at LA County, which takes a couple of hours. They took my picture, booked me, did the anal cavity search alongside these other 8 guys who'd also just recently been arrested. Without a doubt, that was the single worst experience I'd ever had, far beyond everything bad that's ever happened to me. I was lined up with these gang members, all of us right next to each other, and we each had to bend over as the cops went down the line, fucking checking our asses, one after the other. After that meet and greet, they took me into a waiting area to get our cell assignments. In the waiting area, I was handcuffed for 6 hours to a 20-year-old Mexican kid who told me there was a hit out on him by the Mexican mafia. He was in for murder but claimed he'd been framed. The kid was not a bad guy. I feel like I can say that to some degree because let me tell you, there wasn't much else to do but get to know him, sitting there joined at the wrist for 6 hours. Someone had stabbed this kid in the ankle, and he was waiting to be admitted to the infirmary. By the end of this kid's life story, I was totally rooting for him. He came from a really rough background and had definitely done some bad things, but he was pretty nice. The kid's entire back was covered with a huge tattoo of Speedy Gonzalez, done really, really well. That was how I broke the ice. God, that tattoo is great, I said. Who did that? You want a tattoo, man? He said. I'll call my buddy for you. Yeah, that would be great. I've been thinking about getting one. Maybe I will if he's that good. After 6 hours, we were ready to go. They gave us an awful meat sandwich for lunch and told us that when we were done, they'd take us into the general population. And then all of a sudden, this 20-year-old Mexican kid recognizes me from Mad TV. Hey, buddy, I know you, he says. You're the guy from Mad TV. He'd been saying that he thought he knew me on and off for the past 6 hours, but he never made the connection. This guy is on TV, man, the kid shouted loud and stood up, so now the whole group of guys and the guards were looking at him. Your white mama! He started doing an imitation of my most popular character on the show. He did it pretty well, too. Don't make me break my foot off on your ass! Your white mama! He'd aroused the guards' attention, although they clearly weren't Mad TV fans. Who is this guy? One guard asked the Mexican kid. What do you mean he's on television? He's on TV, man! Are you on TV, he asked me. Yes, I'm a comedian on a show called Mad TV, and I also do stand-up, and I've been in a few films, and... You're a comedian, huh? The guard said. Yes. Get this, everybody. We've got a comedian. Why don't you tell us a joke, comedian? Come on, make us laugh, funny man. I felt like I was in a shitty remake of Cool Hand Luke. The guards in L.A. County, in my opinion, could have used an attitude adjustment. I don't hear you. We're waiting to laugh here. Yeah, sorry, buddy. I'm not feeling too funny right now. This guy was a real motherfucker. Oh, you gotta have something if you do stand-up. You're a big comedian on television, he said. Stand up and tell all of us a joke. We could use a joke. He'd made such a scene that everyone in the cell started shouting, Make us laugh, fucker! You better be funny, you motherfucker! Come on, make us laugh! The guard was right there glaring at me. So what's it gonna be, huh? Listen, I wish I could tell you a joke, I said kind of under my breath. I just don't have one, okay? What is that? The funny man doesn't have a joke? He said real loud to my fellow inmates. What good is a funny man without a joke? Now why don't you tell your friends here what you just told me? Yeah, what the fuck, comedian? Tell us a joke. Go ahead, pal, the guard said. Tell him. I stood up and tried to look as tough as I could in such a humiliating situation. I really wish I could entertain you, I said, but I don't have any jokes right now. You better think of one before I kick your ass, motherfucker, someone shouted from somewhere behind me. Yeah, funny man, you better think of something quick, the guard said, grinning a real cocksucker son of a bitch grin at me. I sat down and everybody booed. That's all right, the guard said. We've got a lazy son of a bitch funny man here tonight. Everyone started laughing, of course. Now, what kind of comedian is that? You bring a couch on stage with you? The guy was killing, and I really didn't see why I needed to jump in. So I just sat there, refusing to tell a joke, and eventually they stopped fucking with me. I've never felt so mad about being recognized as a celebrity, but it turned out to be a blessing in disguise. In jail, at least in LA County, every inmate gets a white wristband with their number and name. But if you are one of three things, a celebrity, a snitch for the police, or a murderer, you get a red wristband, which means that you're given your own cell, complete with your own personal shitter. If you have a red wristband, you don't have to deal with the general population at all. That is what my Mexican friend was trying to get from me, but the way it was going, it looked like the opposite was going to happen. Not only was I heading to general population, but now every single person knew me on sight and would definitely be fucking with me. This one asshole guard, for one, showed no signs of letting up. You heard of the show he's on? It doesn't say a lot for Mad TV that no one aside from the Mexican kid had heard of it. It says even less for the LA jail system that this guy was determining whether or not I qualified as a celebrity by polling the other inmates. Fuck that man, I ain't heard of that show. He ain't nobody, fuck him. He ain't funny neither. I never heard of that fucking show, man. The Mexican kid kept telling the guards I was definitely on TV, and he was apparently convincing. I got a red wristband when it was time for us to leave the holding tank and go to our individual cells. You got red, man, Speedy Gonzalez said. That's good, man. You're going to get your own cell. Before that could happen, though, it was time to shower as a group, which was monitored by the guards so nothing horrible happened. It didn't matter. I was convinced that my life was going to end at any second. But if you're expecting a lame drop the soap joke here, you should go read a Wayne Brady book. The shower was uneventful, but my post-shower shit was not. All of the toilets were right next to each other, so while I was doing my business, my knee touched my neighbor's, who was a very large, formidable black man. When he evacuated, I could literally feel the shit tumbling out of him. I must have died today, I thought, because now I am in hell. As romantic as it was when my knee grazed the knee of that heavy-set black gentleman, it didn't last long. We were corralled out of there and divided up according to our bracelets. I was led into a waiting area as the rest of the inmates filed by. A Hispanic kid gave me one hell of an evil eye as he walked past. You got a red band, man? What does that mean, jefe? It means I'm going to be in solitary, I said. Oh, yeah? Well, you don't look like no celebrity I ever seen, and you sure don't look like no murderer. You too much of a pussy to be a murderer, so there's only one thing you can be. You a fucking snitch, ain't you? He turned around to announce to the line of about 35 guys. Hey, this pussy's a fucking snitch. I'm not a snitch, man. I promise you, I said, but it was no use. Well, you ain't Tom Cruise. Is you a snitch? Well, actually, I do a scene with him in a movie called Jerry Maguire that's coming out, I said. He was a dick. It's true, but let me finish this story before I get to that one. Oh, yeah? The kid eyeballed me, trying to figure out if I was lying. So what kind of celebrity are you? I started reeling off my resume to this guy like I was trying to court him to be my agent. Well, in addition to Mad TV, I am also a regular at several comedy clubs in the New York area, and I've been on numerous television commercials. A guard came over and broke that up, and finally I got to my cell, where I remained for the next 3 days and four nights. At some point, the guy in the cell next to me informed me that he was going to be in that small rectangle of a room for another 9 years. I felt claustrophobic, but I couldn't begin to imagine what he was going through, because he looked like he was about 6'9". He didn't have much to say other than that he'd found Christ. Make no mistake, the food in prison is truly awful. Lunch was usually unidentifiable cold cuts on mushy bread, and dinner was usually some kind of nondescript pile of shit, like soggy fucking noodles covered in brown gravy. I remember getting dinner that first night and not eating any, simply because they dared to call that pasta. Like some kind of Guinea Gandhi, I protested by refusing to eat it. In the morning, they served us a couple of eggs with grits that wasn't too bad. The next day, I asked the guard to let me make a phone call. I wanted to check my answering machine at home because it had been 4 days, and I was worried that the bookie in Staten Island might be wondering when he was going to get all of his fucking money. I was scared that if he didn't hear from me, he'd find out where my mom lived or hurt my sister. I filed out of my cell in my orange fucking jumpsuit and went down the hall to get online to use the phone. I had a guard with a shotgun next to me and two gangbangers waiting behind me to use the phone. There was one thing for sure in my life. When it rains, it fucking pours. As I sat there with just about nothing going right, I listened to the first message. Hey, Artie, it's Cameron Crowe, your director on Jerry Maguire. Long time no see, man. I hope everything's going really well. Listen, Artie, I'm really sorry, and I wanted to tell you this personally because you were really great and did such a great job, but we had to cut your scene from the movie. The movie's coming out in 2 weeks, and I didn't want you to wonder what had happened, so I had to call. It was nothing you did at all. You were great. The scene just didn't fit in the film in the end, so we had to cut it. I'm sorry, man. I just didn't want you to go to the film with friends and family and expect to see it and not know that it didn't make it in. But listen, I think you're great, and you did a great job, and I definitely think we'll be working together in the future. Take it easy, Artie. Bye-bye. 8 months earlier, at the end of season one of Mad TV, I'd booked a small part in Jerry Maguire and shot a scene with Tom Cruise and Kelly Preston, both of whom were total douchebags. It was a scene in which their two characters break up and she punches him in the face. It's at the NFL draft, and I play an annoying radio guy who interrupts this moment to having and says, Hey, Jerry, good to see you. Tom Jackson from WHDZ here. Are you going to the big tequila volleyball tournament later? It's going to be great. Then Tom Cruise gives me a fuck-off look. I pause, realize that I'm being an asshole, and kind of creep away. It was a funny, awkward, jokey moment in that scene that didn't make it. It probably would have been a forgettable moment, but what I'll never forget is how fucking insanely rude Tom Cruise and Kelly Preston were. This is before he started couch jumping, but let me tell you, that guy Cruz was already nuttier than a fruitcake. He had this thing about getting his energy to the perfect place before he did a scene, and he would ramp up by jumping rope. He had some guy who was on the payroll for the film stand there holding his jump rope off set. Cruz would jump rope with that insane grin of his until he was ready, then he'd signal Cameron Crowe, toss his rope wrangler his jump rope, step in the scene, Crowe would yell action, and Cruz would go right into it. It was incredibly distracting, and I only had two fucking lines to say to the guy. While I was standing there watching this nonsense, I kept wondering what the fuck he did to ramp up for a love scene. Anyway, we did the scene maybe 20 times, and even though I was standing literally 5 feet from those two, once Cameron Crowe stopped the scene and the production guy went about moving the cameras and stuff, which could take anywhere from 2 to 20 minutes, neither of those fuckers would acknowledge my existence. No eye contact, nothing. I tried to make small talk and Kelly Preston acted like she didn't hear me. And it's not like either of them was playing some difficult character where they couldn't break their focus. Please, they were reciting lines, that was it. Neither one is Laurence Olivier. I did almost punch Tom Cruise, which I probably should have. It might have knocked some sense into that lunatic. I've always shown respect for my writers and the hard work by making sure that when I perform anything, I do the script as written. Particularly in a big-budget movie directed by a guy as cool as Cameron Crowe, I made damn fucking sure that I had my lines memorized correctly. Now, Cruise is the kind of guy who likes to change the dialogue that morning in the makeup chair with no regard for anyone. From the director to the screenwriter to anybody else in their world, who on average are probably a lot smarter than he is. So Cruise had changed what he was going to say and how he was going to play the scene, and no one had informed me. Whatever I was doing by sticking to the script was severely going against his pacing, and judging by the whole jumping rope bullshit, pacing was a big deal to that nutjob. We did a few takes, and on each he seemed to be getting more and more steamed, but he wouldn't look me in the eye or talk to me between takes to tell me what the problem was. He'd only talk to Cameron and say things like, "Cameron, that take was off, the timing was wrong." Finally, he just exploded. He looked at me and screamed, "Can you come in quicker, please?" Everyone got quiet, looked at me in disgust. Cameron called for a break and pulled me aside. "Listen, man, it's not you," he said. "You're doing it exactly as written. Let me go talk to him. He changed his part, so doing it according to the script is throwing him off. You're doing a great job. Just come in quicker, and it'll all be okay." "Of course, no problem," I said. "I wish I'd have known. I'm so sorry I upset him." Not too sorry to punch his fucking dumb grin into the back of his head, however. Once Cameron got Tom back on set, we did the scene according to Tom's invisible pacing meter, and that was it. I was done. What a legendary moment in my acting career. To Cruz's credit, at the end of the take, he yelled, "Thank you," at me. Kelly Preston wasn't any better. She chit-chatted with Tom between takes, but I might as well have been a tree with a pile of dog shit at the base of it. Her elitist attitude extended to every facet of her existence, by the way, which I'd found out the day before. I made friends with one of the PAs and we were playing catch outside the location. As anyone who has ever had anything to do with the production of a feature film can tell you, there is a hell of a lot of downtime. So me and this guy were tossing a baseball when this little dark-haired kid, probably about 4 years old, came running up toward me, so I rolled the ball to him. He picked it up and was kind of staring at it and looking at us, when out of nowhere, like some kind of Aryan superhero, this insanely hot, tall blonde ran over. "What are you doing?" she snapped at me. "You could have killed him." "What are you talking about?" I said. "We just rolled the ball over to him. What's your problem?" "You threw it at him." As she was saying all this, she pulled the ball out of the kid's hands, tossed it on the ground like it was a stick of dynamite, and picked him up really fast. The kid got scared more from her roughhousing than anything we did and started to cry. "See what you've done," she said. "The fuck is wrong with you?" I said. "We're really sorry, ma'am," my friend snapped. "It won't happen again." He gave me a look that said, "Shut up now." "It had better not. No one is to speak to or touch Jet." Then she turned and stormed off with the now bawling kid in her arms. "Jet?" I said, laughing. "Who the fuck names a kid Jet?" "John Travolta and Kelly Preston do, ma'am," my friend said. Apparently, all of the PAs had been given very strict instructions on how to interact with Jet, Kelly, and when he came to the set, John. Let me tell you, playing ball with any of them was definitely not on the rider. Treating them like outer space royalty apparently was. "You don't understand, man. This is really, really bad," the guy told me. "We are under strict orders not to talk to them, look at them, hand them anything, and their kid is so off limits you have no idea. We'll be lucky if we last the day here." Turns out we were lucky. In any event, one of the few things that got me through the hours alone in my jail cell was that bit part in Jerry Maguire. I figured that I was done as far as employment by any major television network went, but at least I had a part in a legitimate big studio, big budget, mainstream film, even if it was a bit part. I could keep doing that, I told myself, and build a film career. I had expected an angry bookie threatening my life and my family, But hearing Cameron Crowe's nice, friendly message was much worse. The fact that he cared enough to remember to call me and tell me himself 2 weeks before the film opened, when he was probably busier than I could imagine, touched me so much that it took all I had to fight back tears. It wasn't just the bad news that made me want to cry. His kindness about did it too. Thank God I controlled myself, considering the setting. "Hey, what's the matter?" the guard said when I hung up. I might not have cried, but I couldn't hide how horribly disappointed I was. "I'm just having a bad day," I said. "Make that a bad week." "Hang in there," he said. He was one of the nice ones. After a few days, I got myself a really good lawyer, Jerry Scotto, who got me out of prison. I got Scotto's name through an assistant director at Mad TV, Tara Passander, who was beautiful and kind and another guardian angel for me out there in L.A. And even though I had the biggest crush on her that you can imagine, she's another one that I haven't seen or spoken to in 12 years. I hope she's doing well, whatever she's doing. Once I got out of jail, I flew directly to New Jersey and entered rehab. I wasn't going to fuck around this time, so I did everything they said to do, including taking these antidepressants prescribed by the shrink. I was completely committed to the program and the course of action. As a result of that, my lawyer had me come back out to L.A., got my case moved to the front of the docket, all for a total of $8,000, and got me probation and time served. The guy was so good that in 18 months, he was able to wipe the arrest from my record. I was allowed to return to New Jersey for rehab and was scheduled to reappear the next January so the court could see how I was doing. The cast at Mad TV was told that I was back home in rehab and would be returning to the show when I could. That's what they said, and that's what they told me, but behind the scenes, they had other plans. It's okay. I owe them my life. The people at Mad TV saved me from killing myself without question. Fax Barr and Adam Small, John Blanchard, Quincy and Salzman, the producers, the creators of the show, I respect them all, I love them all, I miss them all, and I appreciate everything they did for me. In rehab, I saw that Hollywood life is something in my past. I thought my professional career in showbiz was over, and if I were lucky, I'd be taken back by the longshoremen at Port Newark again. I had my big shot on a big network show, and after a couple of turbulent years, I'd blown it. Little did I know that whatever Angel had seen me through wasn't done with me yet. That guide was still on my shoulder, even though I'd put him to the test. He'd had to arrange for the whore to save me from the crazy drug dealer, for my castmates to stop me from attempted suicide, and for some Chicano to recognize me in jail. And he wasn't getting paid overtime. Some boss I am. He wasn't even going to get much of a vacation. I was far from out of the woods, so this guy had to come up with something. He's creative, so he goes big. The next thing he had in store involved a legendary major motion picture studio and the official beginning of my career on the big screen.
Baby Gorilla in the Mist. I'm not going to be all wah, wah about it, but after my stay in rehab in November 1996, following my suicide attempt and then my arrest, I was deeply depressed. I'm sure what contributed to that was my stay in the psych ward at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital in Manhattan. If you've never been there or never heard of it, trust me, it's a big deal. The fact that I'd fucked up so badly right when I had so much going for me really weighed heavily on my mind. Being sober and facing things for the first time was incredibly hard for a guy who buffered anything difficult that ever happened in his life with lots of alcohol and drugs. I returned to my mom's house in New Jersey and immediately locked myself in the basement and became bedridden with depression. I slept about 18 hours a day and felt like my life was over. The only thing I did regularly was go see the shrink that the Mad TV producers and Quincy Jones had recommended. Dr. Hugh Butts, whose office is on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. He is a great, great doctor, and he did the best he could with me. I trusted him. So on his suggestion, I checked into the psych ward and spent the Christmas season and the first few weeks of January 1997 there. It was, hands down, the most depressing period of my life. I had my own room and my own toilet, but I shared a common shower with other people on the floor. My room actually had a great view of the George Washington Bridge, but I didn't care. The only thing I looked forward to was nighttime, when I was allowed to take a couple of Ambien to get to sleep. All I wanted was that little high I'd get from those pills before I crashed. They woke us up at 7 a.m. The first person I'd see was an orderly, a black guy with a speech impediment. Every day he'd come into my room and say, "Artie, breakfast." But the way he said it, it sounded like, "Ari, breath fresh." I always got a kick out of that. Mostly I played Scrabble with people who looked like they just committed mass murder, which was very intimidating. You try telling a kid from the South Bronx with severe anger issues that the word mother isn't spelled M-U-T-H-A. If you find yourself in that situation, take my advice. Give him his triple word score, smile, and wait for group therapy to start. I was in there for 10 days with a one-day break for Christmas dinner when I was released into custody of my mother and sister for 3 hours. We ate at my Uncle Tommy's, and that was really depressing. My mother and sister came to pick me up at the hospital, and they stood by the window trying to make the best of the situation by observing how nice and relaxing it was to look out at the water. But we weren't alone. A nurse and a doctor were required to be there to watch me as I shaved. I'd once tried to commit suicide, so I was on suicide watch and could not be left unattended with so much as a safety razor in my hand. That was too much for my mother, and who could blame her? It was Christmas, and she was picking up her son from the psych ward. My mom is stoic, and she'd been strong through a lot over the years, but this was too much. She burst out crying, and a second later, so did I. In January, I was returned to my family's custody. I locked myself back in the basement, crippled with clinical depression. Anyone who has suffered from it or is familiar with it knows it can incapacitate you mentally and even physically. In my case, I literally could not move. My depression felt like a wet blanket over me, keeping me from getting out of bed. This was the second time I'd been through this in 2 years, the first time being the period leading up to my suicide attempt. Looking back a year later, I could see that I was definitely clinically depressed. I just self-medicated myself with mountains of coke. This time, I had nothing holding the depression in check, and I couldn't handle it at all. For the next 2 months, I gave my mother every excuse in the world about why I could not get out of bed, could not get to the shrink, could not go back to rehab, or do a stay in the psych ward. I couldn't cope with any contact, however small, with the outside world. Some friends who had known me forever tried to see me because, like my family, they were worried about me. I told my mother to send them all away. I wasn't doing much to help myself because I also refused to take my prescribed medication. I'd taken the antidepressant Paxil during my last few weeks with Dr. Butts. I'd taken it the year before, and it had helped me. But like everything else in my life, I just dropped it. After a few weeks of lying there in a stupor, I finally just got sick of being that way. Without drugs or anything else helping me, I woke up one day and suddenly I fucking had it. All the things I berated myself for, the suicide attempt, ruining my career, hurting my family, none of it was going to be made better by staying in bed. I had to make it better through action. The line from The Shawshank Redemption came to mind that day and never left. Either get busy living or get busy dying. I picked the first one. I got myself into New York City to see my manager, Peter Principato, after I rejoined the living. He had been my commercial agent at William Morris for a couple years in the early 90s. Unfortunately, drugs destroyed my relationship with him. But Peter always believed in me, and years later, when I left Mad TV, Peter asked me to be his first client after he left the agency to become a manager. I will always be grateful to Peter for that. We're not together anymore, but Peter is a good guy, and there's nothing I wouldn't do for him. Sitting in Peter's office back in March 1997, I got the bright idea that we should call Mad TV producers Fax Barr and Adam Small and beg them to let me come back on the show. I was in no condition to attend a matinee of Bambi, let alone get back to work doing sketch comedy. But Peter was wise enough and knew me well enough to make that call. It was a bridge I had to cross. We got on a conference call with them and he sat there listening as I shamelessly begged them to let me come back to finish the last episodes of season 2. I promised them that I'd kick ass like I've done before. I promised them that my drug problems were behind me, and I swore up and down that they never have to worry about my mental health again. I told them all the things I've been doing to get back on track. I told them about the psych ward, and I assured them that all I needed to do to get on my feet was to work again. "Art, we love you," Fax said. "And for that reason, we have to insist that you go through the formal rehab. You've gotten through the depression, but you've got to put your demons behind you." They were right, of course, and they stayed on the phone with me for hours until I finally agreed with them. Once we hung up, I had Peter make arrangements to get me into rehab. We settled on a place my mother knew of in New Jersey called Honesty House, which boasted a very high success rate and handled a lot of celebrity clients. My mother's boss of 20 years, Joel Goldberg, ran a company that did psychological profiles for large corporations, including the New Jersey Nets and New York Giants. He was always a great help to our family and very, very generous with us after my father fell. Joel made some calls and got me in the Honesty House right away. I was much more open to the process than I had been before, but my goal still wasn't getting well. I was just hoping that after a few weeks, I'd get a good report card from these people and I'd be able to make it to Mad TV and get my job back. Coming out of that deep depression made me feel like a bear coming out of hibernation. It was early spring and starting to warm up, and I felt like I was emerging from a long, dark sleep. My schedule at Honesty House was group therapy for 4 nights a week from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m., and one-on-one therapy once a week with Kevin, our group leader. Kevin was an older guy who had been clean and sober for 35 years, and believed completely in the Alcoholics Anonymous 12-step program. I followed the steps diligently for 2 straight months and did all the group sessions. All in all, I got a lot out of it. Then I got to the step where you have to write a note to your drug of choice that ruined your life and basically tell it goodbye. You're supposed to think of it as another human being you have wronged. This is where the process broke down for me because I couldn't keep a straight face, sitting there writing a letter to cocaine. In the end, here's what I came up with. Dear Cocaine, you are the guy that I love to hang with, and we had a lot of fun together, but you lied to me quite a bit. You told me that I could stay up for 5 straight days with no problem. You told me that I was way more interesting when I hung with you, and that everyone around me liked to hear me talk incessantly for hours on end. You also lied to me on several occasions when you told me that I could beat up several bouncers at bars. That was completely untrue, and I got stitches and now I have scars on my head to prove it. So goodbye, Cocaine. Take it easy. Artie. When I handed it in, Kevin said, "Well, obviously you're being funny and not taking this seriously. This is not great, Artie. Do it over." It took me about 3 drafts to come up with something sincere enough so Kevin wouldn't think I was making fun of the exercise. I still was, of course, because I still think it's a silly way to make a point. But if it works for some people, I'm not going to fault it. I would have written anything at all at that moment because I was just desperate as hell to get back on TV. Group therapy was a pretty interesting mix of about 15 people. There were girls and guys, older and younger, with 1 or 2 hot chicks in the mix. No matter who was talking, you heard amazing stories. I do a joke in my stand-up based on that, because all I kept thinking as I listened to them was, God, a year ago, this would have been a great fucking party. Now it's just a bunch of self-righteous people telling each other not to do drugs or drink. That's the truth. One of those hot chicks, this beautiful girl with a really nice set of tits, told us how 6 months earlier she used to get so out of her mind drunk that she'd jump on tables, rip her shirt off, and yell and scream for no reason whatsoever. She ended her story by saying, "I'm glad those times are behind me, and I wish all of you would keep from drinking or doing drugs as I have." All I kept thinking was, "Really? I wish it was 6 months ago." I made the mistake of whispering that to a guy sitting next to me, and we both laughed and got in trouble. I felt like I was back in school trying to get laughs and getting yelled at for it. At the end of my 2 months of rehab, I got the official word from Mad TV that they weren't going to pick up my contract for the next season. I'm convinced it was because of the report they got from Honesty House. Because truth be told, I fooled around here and there and didn't finish a few of the steps. Unless it's baseball or comedy, I've never really been much of a team player. But it meant that the Mad TV chapter of my life was officially over. I had gotten fired from Mad TV for my coke problem, and now I had a reputation in Hollywood. But in those 2 years on television, I managed to do enough decent work to make a 5-minute reel of tape that featured a full range of my sketch material. As I finished up my therapy and got myself back together, my agent and manager started sending it out to people so I could get booked for stand-up and other work. Once again, someone was looking out for me because the tape got hits right away. I got called to screen test for 2 network sitcoms. I couldn't really believe it. Being offered screen tests is a big deal because it means you don't have to do the preliminary auditions. I did 5 auditions for Mad TV and was lucky to get that far. Screen test bypassed all of that. It was a message saying that I was good enough to be flown out to LA to audition directly for the casting director, producers, and everyone important. Those calls boosted my confidence astronomically. I started doing a lot more stand-up at all the New York City clubs. The Comic Strip, Stand Up New York, Catch a Rising Star, New York Comedy Club, and Caroline's. Between the comedy and the therapy, I felt like I was getting all of my issues out there and dealing with the shit. I felt ready to screen test for those two shows, and I was completely excited about it. I remember sitting down with my mother one day, feeling like I'd crossed a bridge. "Ma, I think I might be back quicker than I thought." She looked at me for a long minute. "You are back, Artie," she said, "but go slowly this time." The therapist in my group sessions thought I was moving along much too quickly, but I thought he was full of shit. In my mind, the only thing keeping me from being me again was staying out of the game. I felt rested and ready to get back into show business. And considering the interest, show business was ready for me. While my agent negotiated my deal for the screen tests, my manager got a call from Norm MacDonald. I had never met Norm before, but I was a big fan of his. I loved his stand-up, and while I was at Mad TV, Dave Herman and I used to imitate all of his best jokes from SNL's Weekend Update. His style and delivery were perfect. In 1997, Norm was the biggest star on Saturday Night Live, literally the face of the show. So when my manager told me that I was asked to audition as the second lead in a buddy comedy starring Norm, I was ecstatic. The script was written by Frank Sebastiano, a brilliant writer who became my collaborator on Beer League, Norm MacDonald, and the great Fred Wolf, a former head writer for Saturday Night Live and one of the funniest guys I've ever met in my life. I belly laughed at a lot of the jokes when I read the script. Norm's voice came right through, and I totally loved his best friend character, Sam McKenna. When I finished it, I called my manager and told him I had to do this movie. It was called Dirty Work. It was a big deal, an MGM feature produced by Robert Simons. For those who don't know, Bobby Simons produced Problem Child, which made a lot of money, as well as all of Adam Sandler's films, Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, and The Wedding Singer. On top of having a huge producer involved, a major studio, plus Norm, the biggest star on SNL, I found out the guy who had signed on to play my character's father in the film was Jack Warden. Hands down, Jack is one of my heroes. Chris Farley was also signed on to play a supporting role, and Don Rickles had a cameo. Chevy Chase had a cameo, too. There was even talk that Adam Sandler and Howard Stern might also do cameos. To top it all off, Bob Saget, a guy I admired but never met, was directing. It was a major project, no doubt about it. "They want to test you," Peter, my manager, told me. "We've got to get you on a plane immediately. You're going to fly out there and screen test with Norm in the room. Possibly Bob Simons and Bob Saget, too. They're going to videotape you to show you to the powers that be at MGM. You are going to do it in Bob Saget's office in Santa Monica." He paused for a moment. "Artie, you need to tell me if you could do this, and you need to be very honest with me and with yourself." "Peter," I said, "look at me. I promise you I could do this. There's nothing else I want to do in this world but this." I meant it 100%. He could see it in my eyes. "Okay, Artie, then let's do it." When I walked into the Dirty Work audition, I wanted that job more than a hobo wants a steak. If I got it, as far as I was concerned, I would be getting back into the business in the best possible way. This film was going to feature just about all of my heroes in comedy. Working with them was my dream homecoming. I was nervous as hell when I got out to LA because the last time I'd been there, aside from my court appearance, I'd been arrested, high out of my mind, and thrown produce at my agents and producers at a supermarket. So that was on my mind, but I made up for it by preparing well. Bob Saget, Norm MacDonald, and Norm's assistant Laurie Joe, who became one of my favorite people in the whole world, were in the room for my audition. They taped my performance, and I thought I did well, except for the fact that during the whole thing, Norm never got up from the couch. He just lay there the entire time saying things like, "Hey man, thank you for coming out. Good to see ya." What was even more confusing was that Saget was like a hyper kid, jumpy, happy, and enthusiastic the whole time. He was probably as excited as I was because a chance to direct a talented group like that was a big opportunity for him. The next day, Saget, Norm, and Bob Simons called me on a conference call in my hotel room. "So," I said, "how was it?" "Well," Norm said, taking this dramatic pause, "it was great." Then Saget chimed in, "Yes, it was, Artie. You were great." To be honest with you, I had no idea what that meant at all. Maybe they liked it, and they were trying to let me down easy. Maybe they knew about my past and didn't want some kind of freak out on their hands. That was all they told me. Then they hung up. I sat there staring at a wall wondering what the hell they just told me when the phone rang again. "Hey man, it's Norm," he said. "Listen, we have to see some other people, but you did an amazing job." "Well, thanks, man. That means a lot. We can't say anything for sure yet, but let's just go shoot some pool in Hollywood tonight." We were all in Santa Monica, so they picked me up, and we drove to the pool hall, which is about 30 minutes away on Fairfax and Sunset. Once I got in the car with Norm and Bob, the real meaning of the outing became crystal clear. "So, Artie, we want you to know that we want you in this movie," Norm said. "You were great today, man, and we think you're perfect for the part," Saget said. "Well, I want to do it, there's no question of that," I said. "That's great," Norm said. "There's just one thing. You don't have the greatest track record." "Guys, I will be as good as a second-grade ballerina," I said. "You will not see me doing drugs, and there's nothing I won't do to make sure that if I get this part, I won't lose it." "That's great, Artie," Norm said. "That's what we want to hear, and I think you really mean it." In typical me fashion, I was feeling so good that by the time we got to our destination, I was ready to ruin it. What I'm about to tell you is so embarrassing, but it's the reality of being an addict. We got to the pool hall, we started shooting pool, we had a few drinks, and here's how stupid I got. "So Artie, we know about the drugs," Saget said, eyeing me and my third Jack and Coke. "But how are you with the booze?" "Oh man, fine," I said. "That was never the problem. Just Coke, man. I can drink. It's totally fine. It never got in the way." I'm not sure if they were comforted by that. I doubt it. But as if to prove my retarded point, I started drinking and I started winning at pool. And because of that, after a while, I felt like I had the part, no problem. I got happy. I did about 7 shots of tequila in front of them. There was no one there to come out of the corner and smack me on the head to remind me that I was one step away from getting or losing the part in a movie, so maybe getting brazenly drunk in front of these guys wasn't the best idea. No, I was feeling so confident about my position with them that after I slammed my last shot, I didn't think twice about very obviously asking one of the 4 Mexican guys playing pool next to me if he can get me some cocaine. I'd been kind of talking to the guy for a minute because he recognized me from Mad TV, which in my drunk logic made me think that I was even more valuable in Norm's and Saget's eyes. The coke transaction wouldn't matter to them. Besides, I was so slick, they wouldn't even know. "Hey man," I whispered drunkenly to this kid. "So you know me, right? Can you get me some coke? I got money, man." "What?" the kid said. No, man. I don't sell coke, man." "Oh yeah? Well, no problem." One look back at Saget and Norm proved to me that we hadn't been whispering. It didn't help that after he talked to his buddies for a minute, this guy came back to me. "It's cool, man," the guy said. "I'll give you my number. We'll score for you tomorrow, okay?" I was already aware that my drug trafficking wasn't going down unnoticed, but I didn't care. I got the guy's number as Norm and Saget watched. They didn't say anything, but they wrapped things up. Norm went home to his place in West Hollywood, and Saget drove me back to Santa Monica to my hotel. I was definitely drunk, and they definitely weren't. I got to my room, I ordered myself a cheeseburger from room service, and the next morning I woke up with a beef patty on my chest, half eaten. I looked over at the clock, it was 9 a.m. In about 10 seconds, the entire evening came back to me. Anyone who's ever been drunk, been dumb, and remembered the next morning in bed knows what I'm talking about. The depression and disappointment I felt when I realized what I had done washed over me, and it was as overwhelming as my harshest drug withdrawals. I couldn't understand myself at all. I told myself not to act that way, and then I'd done it. And there I was, waking up to my own actions once more. There was a terrace visible through the window, and I thought about jumping off of it. But I promised myself that I'd never do that, or even try to do that again, so I just sat there feeling helpless. I wasn't going to go against 2 promises I made myself back to back. I started to cry, thinking there was nothing else in the world that I could possibly fuck up in this life. By 11 a.m., I'd been pacing around my hotel room with the shades drawn for 2 hours, wondering whether I should just go for broke and start drinking and doing drugs again until I died, or if I had a chance to rescue this thing.